Senate Committee on Business and Labor, and we're going to have a little change in the order here. We're going to do Senate Bill 375 first and then 372. So, Senator Purdy, are you here available? You want to speak on 375, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the Business and Labor Committee. For the record, my name is Ginny Burdick, and I represent Senate District 18.
Oh, is Rogers coming?
Oh, no.
Where's my camera?
We're already on the Internet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Roger Byer, State Senator, District 9.
Thank you. It's a particular pleasure to sponsor this bill with Senator Byer, who feels as strongly on this subject as I do. Senate Bill 375 is a pretty straightforward, simple bill. It would expand the Oregon no-call program to non-residential customers. Right now, private residences can put themselves on a no-call list and pay a small fee and be protected from mostly cold calls from solicitors. Under Senate Bill 375, businesses along with residential customers would be able to pay a minimal fee and add any or all of their business telephone numbers to the Oregon no-call list that telemarketers are legally required to abide by. There are over 5,000 businesses in Oregon, and currently they are denied the ability to register with the no-call list. I believe they have the same rights to privacy that residential customers have. I can actually speak from personal experience on Senate Bill 375. I'm one of a growing number of Oregonians with a home office and a business telephone line. Because it is a registered business line, I'm not eligible to currently subscribe to the no-call list. In my case, the constant disruption of solicitations at all hours of the day and evening serve no useful purpose for my business and are quite frankly annoying. If it were a private line, I definitely would be on the no-call list by now. And I believe that I have a right as a business customer to have these calls stopped. Senate Bill 375 has several important exemptions that protect public agencies, charities, and businesses. The no-call provisions would not be available in the following circumstances, just as they are not available for business, for residential telephone lines. It's not available if the business asks the telemarketer to call, if the telemarketer calls on behalf of a public agency or a charitable organization to which the business belongs, or to which the business has previously donated or has expressed an interest in donating. If the call is a political poll or opinion survey unrelated to the marketing of any property, goods, or services, it could not be on the no-call list. And finally, if the call is from a business that has sold goods or services to your business in the past, then it would not be eligible for the no-call list. It would not be affected by the no-call list. I believe this bill, with the exemptions that it provides, establish adequate protections for both telemarketers and businesses. It is an optional program. Businesses would not be required to join, but would have the opportunity to do so. I urge the committee to support Senate Bill 375. And I also will say that I will also be presenting testimony for the record, if I may, Mr. Chairman, from a constituent of mine from Tigard, who actually is a small business person like myself and requested this bill before the session started. Thank you.
Do you have a written testimony?
I have written testimony that has been submitted for the record from me, and I believe my constituent's testimony will be here by the end of the hearing. Thank you.
Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, member of the committee. I guess just ditto to what Senator Burdick just said. As an owner of a small business, I receive a lot of calls, unsolicited telemarketing calls. And it's, you know, I guess it just, I saw it as a matter of fairness. Many people have home offices, and they don't want to be bothered any more than people who just don't want to bother at home. And that reason I agreed to co-sponsor the bill with Senator Burdick and start the debate. And as you are well know, there is a sort of a companion bill on the docket today also. I think it's Senate Bill 262.
That's correct. Yeah.
Sponsored by Senator Metzger, dealing with facts. And actually, in my business, I have one line for my business, and it's also a fax line. Mm-hmm. And my fax machine is constantly tied up. with faxes that I end up throwing away because there are just unsolicited business to business advertising. So I'm looking forward to hearing the discussion on that bill also.
Very good. Any questions on this? This is too esteemed.
Mrs. Christine, down here, up here.
Okay, anything at all?
No.
Thank you very much.
Kevin Neely.
Good deal.
What's that for all this? I'm not speaking to people. Kevin, welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name's Kevin Neely. I'm the Executive Assistant to the Attorney General of the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice is here in support of Senate Bill 375. We believe that this bill conforms the current Oregon no-call list to include businesses, and that provides businesses with some enhanced protections and really gives businesses back their ability to use their phone lines for exactly what they intended them to use for, their own businesses. Right now, we get a significant number of calls from businesses asking us if they can participate in this because they're inundated with these phone calls that take away from the time they can be spending with their own customers. We've had to unfortunately continue to tell them, sorry, the law doesn't allow us to extend this to businesses. So for that reason, we do believe that this is an important bill and should pass. Additionally, we would like to, and I've talked to Senator Burdick, and I apologize, Senator Beyer, we haven't had a chance to run these by you. We would like to offer some brief amendments to this bill. As you may know, currently the federal government has initiated or is working towards initiating a nationwide no-call list. As part of that no-call list, they've proposed a national registry. Right now, the Oregon no-call list requires those who subscribe to the list to pay an initial fee of $6 and thereafter pay a fee of $3 annually. What that fee does is it essentially supports the list administrator. If these amendments can go through, what it does is it allows our office the flexibility to move that administration to the federal government if the funding exists. Right now, there is no funding. But if they do get the funding, then they would create a nationwide no-call list, and that list would be available for free to all Oregonians. So we could remove all the costs to Oregonians to get on this list, and if this bill were to pass, also to businesses, essentially making the no-call list free. Right now, we have about 120,000 patrons. I think we would see that number skyrocket if indeed they didn't have to pay an annual fee, and we believe that this is a service that ought to be provided to consumers at no charge if there's any way for us to do it. But again, I've provided those amendments to the committee of assistance. They haven't been drafted yet, and I apologize that we're late on that.
But how does the procedure work if you get a complaint or you find somebody is violated? Whatever we have in place now.
Sure.
How does that work and what is the... How do you prosecute it?
Chair, committee members, how it works is we get a complaint filed with our office, and we would pursue those complaints just like we would any other Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It's under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and upon a complaint, usually we'd contact the business. If there are multiple offenders, we would then seek to work with them on some sort of settlement agreement. If they weren't agreeable to that, then we would seek additional action.
When they're out of state, I mean...
It really, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it doesn't really matter. We go after them anywhere. In fact, we can seek action against even international callers. We don't see that happen with the telemarketing because they're generally calling from somewhere in the U.S. But, frankly, we've had enforcement actions throughout the U.S. on this law.
Questions?
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Chair, it works really well because Discover Card called me like 4 or 5 times in a 6-week period, and I nailed them. It was the last time they were going to do that to me on a no-call list. So my question for you is now that the federal government is thinking about doing this no-call list, are they modeling their law after Oregon? Are we sort of, did we set the tone for the country, so to speak?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's a great question. In fact, the nationwide no-call list we perceive to be a little bit more lenient than the Oregon no-call list. We and the other states, I think there are about 20 states that have existing laws, have worked with the FTC to get our law grandfathered in. And so any states that have existing laws, at least as the current federal legislation is written, would be able to enforce the state law. It wouldn't be secondary to the federal law.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay, and this is something the federal government may do. Is there a timetable, or what's your feel on that?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what the timetable is. I know that it's been working through. The legislation has passed to create the list, but it's the appropriation that's languishing. And so, frankly, it may never come to pass. Again, what this amendment does, it doesn't mandate that the state goes this route. In fact, our list administrator right now is excellent, and they've done excellent work, and we're very appreciative of the work. And if the FTC can't provide comparable service, frankly, I don't think we'd go with them.
Who is your administrator?
I don't know the name of the list administrator, but someone here does. He's probably raising his hand. He represents them. He's going to be up here in a minute telling you that he doesn't like this amendment.
Oh, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the interest of time, as you know, on 262, basically we had an amendment to make 375, but 262 would include facsimile machines. This talks about telephone. You have any comment on using, also adding the facsimile lines to that no call?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I think that we found similar instances, as Senator Beyer intimated earlier, where businesses are getting inundated by these. But we don't, again, I think that's a policy decision for the legislature. If they choose to put them in there, obviously we'll enforce them with vigor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, Kevin.
Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Janice Jarvis and Lynn Lundquist. Welcome. I'm just going to start this one. Jana, you were signed up first.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jana Jarvis. I represent the Oregon Association of Realtors. We're a trade association of nearly 13,000 members. And I've come before the committee today actually with a couple of questions. I'm looking for some clarification. On Senate Bill 375, if I look at the testimony from Senator Burdick, there's a in the fourth bullet point, it said, if the call is from a business that has sold goods or services to your business in the past. My question, when we looked at Senate Bill 375, we were unsure whether or not this would exempt us, and for both Senate Bill 375 and Senate Bill 262, in having communication with our own business members of our trade association, per se. But when I look at Senator Burdick's statement here, I don't see that bullet point included in this piece of legislation, and that would, if that was in fact included, I think that we would feel better about that.
What was that again?
Her statement says, if the call is from a business that has sold goods or services to your business in the past, that would talks about a pre-existing business relationship, which is exempt. When I look through Senate Bill 375, I don't see that.
Okay.
May I make one other comment? If I may, I would just make a comment on Senate Bill 262 while I'm up here, since I have a quick statement. In that bill, on line 23, when it talks about the facsimiles, one of the ways that we communicate with our members is through a every other week facsimile. So when it talks about on line 22, solicitations made by a charitable organization, a public agency, or volunteers on behalf of the organization, if that was changed to any organization, that would allow us to continue communicating with our own members.
You want to do this?
We would like to be able to do that, and I would certainly hope that Senator Metzger would want us to be able to communicate with our members. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any questions? Yeah. Okay, thank you. Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On I'm president of the Oregon Business Association, and we represent very large businesses and very small businesses, and I think this probably has more bearing in regard to some of the smaller businesses. And I would go along with what Real Estate Association is saying, and we certainly want to be able to continue to communicate with our members. Having said that, however, you know, I think that we do live in a day of age here, obviously, where telecommunication is very vital to our business. By the same token, however, I don't think we necessarily have to take the bad with the good, as the saying goes. I think there's an opportunity here to close the door a little bit, and I think it's only reasonable to accept the fact that if a business just chooses not to want solicitation, they ought to have that opportunity. I think that's just, it seems to me, just a business right, if you will. And I do a lot of calling on the telephone, working with trying to get new members and so forth. And frankly, if I know there's a business that doesn't want solicitation calls, it just saves me time. I mean, to me, it's an efficiency move. And Mr. Chairman, and I'm sure Senator Beyer, both all three of us have been in agriculture, and I would guess that you have had business calls at 4 or 5 in the morning from the East Coast wanting to sell you either fertilizer or weed killer or some such thing. I don't know about you, but as a business, I don't appreciate those kind of calls. And I think that it's a logical progression as we move through in the telecommunication process, and we ought to be able to be astute enough to be able to sort out that which works and that which doesn't work. So on behalf of the Oregon Business Association, we think this is a tool that ought to be pursued.
Okay, good. Questions? Jake?
Thank you, Lynn. Very good. Paul Romaine and Brandt, are you coming up too?
Yes.
Okay. Come on up, yeah. Who wants to start here?
You like Paul?
Okay, I'll go first. My name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here representing a number of different clients, MCI WorldCom and the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association. And for the purposes of this, also Paul Romaine, attorney at law. We're in opposition to 375, except after some testimony here, we wouldn't mind a gut and stuff to put the Attorney General's amendments in, which is where Brandt and I will disagree. And I'll get to that in a second. The reason you went to no call in the first place was because you made a policy decision that you have a group of people, homeowners or people living in their homes, and it wasn't appropriate to bombard them with phone calls if they didn't want to get bombarded. It's sort of a big class of people. It was inappropriate to be calling them at 6 o'clock, at 6:10, 6:20, 6:30, whatever, all the way through the evening. And that was a policy decision you, as a legislature, made. And it's a legitimate one to protect that class of people. You're now looking at, with 375, expanding that to all businesses out there. Now, there's a point where government has to say, is it really appropriate for us to step in at this point? Are we shutting off a legitimate sales technique where it's a business-to-business call? We're not talking about a personal call. We're talking about a business. Now, sometimes businesses are located in a home, but it's a business. What businesses do is we have to communicate with people. Sometimes they're not part of our own little group. About selling them things, because that's what businesses normally do. I sell services. Now, as an attorney, I don't do cold calling. I do get lots of cold calls from stockbrokers. And, you know, every once in a while, it's interesting to listen to them. I do make cold calls on behalf of the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. What I do is I call folks who aren't members of our association. What this would do is force me to go out and purchase that list before I made every one of those phone calls. And, you know, I'm just talking to them about the different things that we have in the association and maybe they should join. Now, I don't think it's appropriate to step in, for example, like my petroleum marketers. Maybe they get a great deal on lube supplies and they want to, in effect, call folks out there that have never done business with them but they have some really interesting new stuff. Well, what you're saying to them now is they have to go and find, get this no-call list, purchase the no-call list, and then go forward. We think that's inappropriate. We think it's beyond what government should be jumping into. I can understand why you would be jumping into residential, because you do have a more vulnerable class of people, if you would, but you're talking about business-to-business phone calls here. Having said that, the federal government has devised a no-call list. And frankly, it was because of pressure of states like Oregon and others who have had their own no-call lists all around. And we, WorldCom, MCI, other folks, like the idea of a national list. It's just easier to operate off of a national list because there's one. It's one-stop shopping. You talk about here some of the improvements in government are going to one-stop permit shopping. It's the same thing with if there is going to be a no-call list, make it national. Make it easy to get on and make it easy to get to. So the idea of going to it, there was an appropriation, I believe, Thursday night of $16 million or something like that for the It was $16 million to fund the national Do Not Call list. It was in the omnibus appropriations bill for 2003, passed by both House and Senate Thursday night. So you are going to have funding for this national list. Now, Brandt's going to tell you, I mean, he does a wonderful job. They do an absolutely great job, and it's a moneymaker for their group, and it's a good thing, and they really do. It was very efficient. We like the idea of the no-call list in Oregon when it was, there was one central administrator for it. But now you have the opportunity to go to a national situation. It makes it a lot easier for national companies to operate. So we would support the AG amendment as long as the bill was gutted and that was the only thing left. Be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Metzger.
Mr. Romaine, that was a very interesting point of view. I'm curious, though, how you see, since this is a voluntary action by a business owner, and one can make the case that they may or may not be a wise business owner to preclude calls from other businesses, but the bottom line is on the no-call list, that is the choice of the individual. And I'm curious as to why you feel that they should have any less of a choice because they operate a business than if they live in their own home. I mean, this is something that they do proactively. They're not precluding anything that they don't want to preclude.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, my problem isn't so much with them making a choice that I shouldn't call them. My problem is with me now having to go out and buy the list whenever I'm going to have to try and figure out who I'm supposed to call or can call or can't call. It's that kind of thing. And at which point, I can make all types of policy arguments why I should go forward with expansion of this list. I could add to this some of my relatives. I mean, I could have a lot of folks on this list, some of my wife's relatives that I would love to put on a no-call list. They can't call me. But you're not going to go that far as a government. You're not going to protect me. I'd like you to protect me against some of the stupid advertisements on radio. Whenever I hear them, I shut the radio off. It drives me nuts. But you're not going to protect me against that stuff. What you're trying to decide is at which point does government say it's time for us to intervene and require somebody to, in effect, go out and buy something else? And what I'm saying is, and we may have a disagreement on this, not that we've disagreed on anything else, but that there is a limit, and this commercial no-call is not a good way to go.
One follow-up.
Sure. Yes.
Okay. Just so that I could kind of put a dustpan around your comment then. What you're saying, though, is, I mean, I think the argument you're making, Paul, is that it's inconvenient for a business to have to purchase the list, and that outweighs the inconvenience for the business that has to put up with the calls. And I don't understand why that should have precedence over the business who has decided that it's inconvenient for them to be called at 4 in the morning or 6 in the morning or whatever.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I may have a solution for you. Basically, if you can require that the business no-call list, segregate out businesses by the type of business that they're in. So the only thing I would have to purchase is 100 or so numbers from the petroleum retailers out there who I'm going to sell new lube products to. then maybe I would agree with you on that thing. But if you're requiring me to go out and get a list and then make the calls and basically sort through, then, you know, I'm going to pay for the whole thing, and I'm going to really, all I'm looking at is about 100 numbers there. I mean, there are logistical problems with things like that. And again, you can still require it. It's me. I have to go out and buy it. It's another cost of doing business. You're making it more difficult for me to get to some of my potential customers. That may be a choice you make. But what I'm saying is that in a business-to-business situation, the need for government intervention isn't as great as it is when it's a business-to-consumer.
I don't necessarily agree with that, but that's a good argument.
Is anybody talking about this alleged growth of government into people's lives? Do you have any comment on that?
No, but I do have a question for Senator Metzger when we get to Senate Bill 262.
And I will leave before that.
Thank you, Paul. It's always a pleasure to have you in front of the committee.
Never know what I'm going to say until I get it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Brent, please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Brant Wolf, for the record, Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and the OTA is, in fact, the private list administrator for the Oregon Do Not Call program. Initially, we had kind of a supportive point of view of Senate Bill 375, and we still would, barring any amendments such as those the Department of Justice has brought forth. It's interesting to me that one of the reasons to have this program move up to the Federal Trade Commission is because it's free. It would become free, and that's mentioned in the same breath almost as the $16 million appropriation to support it. So I kind of, nothing is free, and neither would the Oregon No-Call program. It's not free now, and it wouldn't be free if it moved to Federal Trade Commission. It would just be shifted to other places. The program cost initially $6.50 to sign up for it for the first year, and $3 per year after that. And I would submit that it would be difficult to find a quasi-governmental program that is that inexpensive and works as well as the Oregon No-Call program. The bottom line, I think, for the OTA is that the Oregon No-Call program is just that. It's the Oregon No-Call program, and it should stay the Oregon No-Call program. It shouldn't move to the Federal Trade Commission or any other entity with the word federal in front of it. It was created here in Oregon, and it should stay here in Oregon, and that's why I would ask you not to support any amendments to move the Oregon No-Call program away from Oregon. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Could you help Mr. Romaine if he only wanted to buy 100 lists, 100 of those names out of there?
I'm sure we could work out some deal with Mr. Romaine.
Okay. Senator White.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. All kidding aside, can you, when people sign up, if you're doing businesses, can you ask them on the form what category their business is in and then segregate that? And does that add expense to your program, or is that just a computer programmer deal and
Chairman Nelson,
click of a button?
Chairman Nelson, Senator Walker, we do things like that now. There are folks who don't have computers that generate their calling programs. They do it all by hand, smaller mom-and-pop types of situations. They can buy the list and just comb through it and get what they want off of it. I think if Senate Bill 375 minus any amendments were passed out of this committee and signed into law in the rulemaking process, we could address any concerns like you're talking about. You can segregate the list up however you want it and get what you want out of it. It's very easy to do.
Then follow-up. That's great. I think that answers Mr. Romaine's one of his questions. But the other one is, you don't want it to become a federal program because you want it to stay in Oregon, but is that because you make money off the program, or is, I mean, let's just be blunt.
Sure. Yeah, I don't mind that question. I will admit to that. The Oregon Telecommunications Association does get some revenue from that. Most of it goes to the actual that we subcontract with to actually do the data input. That's where most of the work is. That's where most of the money goes.
Uh-huh.
But the OTA itself does generate some revenue per year to support our association, absolutely.
And if we adopted these amendments to make it flow into the federal program, the federal government would take it over and it would become free.
That's right, and all that money would go to the federal government, not little old me.
It is okay for people to make money.
It is okay, I know. I can't imagine that the government's telling me that it's free. No, it's not. Somebody's making money off of it.
Exactly.
No, I'm good for now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brent, how large is the no-call list now with just residential people on it?
Chairman Nelson, Senator Beyer, we have about 114,000 Oregonians signed up. That's the last update I got.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do you know out of how many residential phone lines in the state?
There are approximately 2 million, give or take, 100,000 or so.
Thank you.
We'll follow up to that.
Yes,
please. So 114,000 out of 2 million, that's not enough. So either people don't know about it or they don't care to get interrupted at dinner. What do you suspect?
Chairman Nelson, Senator Walker, there. Advertising the program has been kind of a problem. We started out with no budget. It was $0. We had no money to advertise, so it's really been kind of word of mouth and through the efforts of the smaller members of the Oregon Telecommunications Association that we've been able to advertise through our bill inserts about the program. Once we've gotten some money in the bank, which we have now, we've done some direct mail marketing, and that's the reason it's up to 114,000. I mean, we had a huge month in December. In November, we had about 80,000. So, and the program was in effect for 2 years prior to that. So, in 2 years, we got 80,000, and you know, 4 months, we've gotten another 35,000. Mm. And I would expect that to just grow. At some point, there's going to be kind of a the word escapes me, but the word of mouth, and as more people sign up, it'll grow on its own weight, and that number will get bigger over time.
Well, I might recommend that you should target seniors because I get lots of seniors signed up for the program and they love it because they can't hear very well on the phone and they get talked into buying things that they don't need. So if you get them signed up on the no-call list, they don't get bothered anymore.
I agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I disagree with what Senator Walker, how she started to ask questions. She said that's not enough. 114,000 and 2 million. I think that's the perfect amount because this is an optional program. So 114,000 out of 2 million roughly phone lines have chosen to pay extra money. To say we have to get more people signed up, I disagree with that statement. It's an optional program. And if no, I'm personally, I've never signed up. My residence is on these. I don't want to pay $650 for a startup, $3 a year. It's my choice, and I think that's where we need to keep it. We don't need to be mandating people into this.
This means you can hang up if they call.
I'm not mandating anything, Senator Beyer. I think we just need to make
it. If I may respond to that, I couldn't agree more. And if it moves to the Federal Trade Commission, you would pay for it, whether you had it or not.
Love these telecom bills, though.
Thank you.
Anything else? Any other questions? Any other witnesses?
I was having a comment.
Yes.
I agree, Senator. Actually, 114,000 is quite a few. I mean, it's people who are motivated enough to do that. I think that is a significant amount. I think if we were to also delete the political calls from this and add that to the no-call list, I bet you we would have 1.5 million residents.
Potentially so. Thank you, Brad. Appreciate it. Anybody else wish to sign up and testify on this bill? We have proposed amendments, and we can mull upon all the testimony here and see where we have. I'll close the public hearing. We will not go into a work session. Close the public hearing. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 262. And
just me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Metzger.
I think I'll just do that right here. I think we pretty well covered that. Actually, in drafting of Senate Bill 262 was to include the businesses, and it was along with the facsimile machine. Not included, which is why you have a -1 amendment, which puts the business-to-business contacts in there. But I'm particularly pleased about Senator Beyer and Senator Burdick's joint efforts on 375, and should they see the value of also including facsimile machines to that, I would just prefer that be amended into Senate Bill 375. That's it.
Okay, good. And Jana, you already testified, so for the record on 262 that...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask Senator Metzger a question?
Yes, please.
I think he just answered my question with his testimony, but as drafted, 262 would not include businesses.
Right.
But, and I would, so.
Right. Yeah, it was an error. So the dash one took care of that, but it would be just as easy to put it in 375.
And for the record, the Janet Jarvis's comment representing the Oregon Association of Realtors was on line 22 and
23
of line 1, that there was some...
Take the word BF and put any in, I think makes sense. Yeah, clarifies.
So if we just put that for a matter of record, and then we'll look at these two bills jointly. Any further testimony on 262? If none, we'll close the public hearing on it, and we will not go into work session. So close public hearing. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 328. Save my best for the last. Thank you, thank you. Okay, we have Don Miner, Greg Harmon, Diane Belt, John Brenneman. You want to all come up here reasonably close and do this?
To go one, two,
welcome. Three. Thank you for coming.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of Senate Bill 328. Our goal in requesting this legislation was to have to allow certain manufactured homes that are located in rental communities to be converted to real estate. And our hope in having that process allowed is to have these homeowners qualify to have their mortgages bought by Freddie Mac, which is a federal corporation, with the object of having their interest rates reduced from the current 9 to 13% that folks in parks pay to more like 6%. Freddie Mac, as I said, it's a federally chartered entity created in 1970 by Congress, and they go out and they purchase mortgages from banks around the country. They securitize those to sell the paper to investors, and with that, then generate a flow of lower cost mortgage money. This is not a government subsidized program or anything like that. It's just a conventional home loan program. Recently, Freddie Mac extended its program to include manufactured homes located in rental parks so long as they are titled as real estate under existing state law. Now, in 1983, the Oregon legislature, through House Bill 2777, allowed manufactured homes that are on property owned by the person who owns the home to extinguish the title if the home had been previously titled, or if not previously titled, to never title the home. And those homes then are recorded, and the home and the land are sort of merged into a package. They become real estate in the sense of any other home on that same lot. And we treat those under Oregon law as real property. The state of Washington in 1987 adopted a law patterned after House Bill 2777, except there they extended the application of the law. Well, the Oregon law did not cover homes and parks. When Washington did their law in 1983, they extended it to include manufactured homes located in rental communities so long as they were on a leasehold interest of 35 or more years. And it's my understanding that currently, then, folks who have such leases in rental communities in the state of Washington are able to get the lower interest rates offered by Freddie Mac lenders. Senate Bill 328 extends, then, the existing Oregon law to cover manufactured homes located in parks under certain conditions. One of the conditions is that the leasehold interest be 30 or more years in length. The way that would work then is Freddie Mac also requires that the lease be 5 years longer than the mortgage. So this would allow a person to get as little as a 25-year mortgage and have a 30-year lease. It also requires approval of all parties who claim an interest in the home or the land, as well as the landlord, the consumer, and the lender. So it's an agreement that is reached The bill also contains an emergency clause. Our hope in including that was that, assuming the legislature and the governor thought this was a good idea, that we would make this lower-cost mortgage money available to our consumers right away. The bill does need at least one amendment. In speaking to the folks at Freddie Mac, we spoke to Judy Agard. She's the assistant general counsel there. She had wanted to have the word recorded added immediately preceding the word leasehold estate, and that occurs in about three places in the bill. And I don't believe that amendment has been prepared yet, although it has been requested. Also, other legislation pending in the building, Senate Bill 468, it takes manufactured housing out of DMV, including this provision of law, and transfers it to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So somebody needs to be aware that depending on which bill passes first, now that all works out, that there be a conforming amendment so that this this bill, if approved, would go into law. And with that, I conclude my remarks and would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, well, I was going to go with Greg unless somebody has something.
Was that just one question? Yes, thank you. Is that Senate Bill 428?
468.
468.
Okay.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Greg Harmon. I'm president of Commonwealth Real Estate Services in Lake Oswego. We are the largest manufactured home community management company in Oregon and Washington, representing about 100 manufactured home communities, about 10,000 home sites. Also, as a small business owner and manager, I'm all for the expanding the no-call bill to businesses, especially with facts. I think that's a great. I'm one of the 114,000, and it works great. I'm a member of the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, and I'm also this year's president of the Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. My family began in the manufactured housing business in 1964. My father did. My brothers and I have been in the industry ever since. I've had about 35 years in the industry, second-generation guy, and have seen a lot of financing programs come and go in our industry, and I'm here clearly speaking in for Senate Bill 328. A few highlights of what we from the industry see as benefits of this bill. It increases consumers' access to affordable housing by allowing manufactured homes in a land lease or rental space community to be converted to real property from personal property when accompanied by the 30-year lease is offered under the Freddie Mac program. It gives homeowners and lenders the ability to convert the home from personal property to real property, which we believe has many, many ancillary benefits to the homeowner and will have a positive effect on the marketability and resale of the home. This gives consumers seeking affordable housing access to lower mortgage rates and monthly payments when purchasing a manufactured home. The 30-year land lease provides consumers with assurances as to the future costs of a manufactured home rental space, giving them stability and consistency in their monthly housing costs. The current Freddie Mac rates, as Don mentioned earlier, hover around 6% interest rates. Typical manufactured home personal property type loans available on the market today unfortunately range from, as Don said, 9 to 13% annual percentage rate. Lower interest rates and more stability in the ongoing costs of the home ownership makes the home a better investment, and it also limits the risks to the lenders. Industry experts agree that the access to conforming financing, this is what we refer to as conforming mortgage financing, for manufactured homes and land lease communities will reduce the current levels of repossessions and foreclosures in our industry, which has been a problem the last few years. The current glut of repossessions is destroying some homeowners' equities, and it's making it very difficult for them to sell their homes. Access to this conforming rate financing will make additional sources of refinancing available to these homeowners. That will allow them to lower their monthly housing costs if they qualify. It gives lenders, Freddie Mac approved lenders, guarantees regarding the future cost of manufactured home ownership, which they don't have now, giving loan underwriters reliable information they need to make an intelligent lending decision. It provides manufactured home community owners, which I represent, especially those struggling today with increased vacancies, something to offer those people seeking affordable housing and long-term stability in their housing expense. And it also helps lenders reach their Community Reinvestment Act goals. There's really very little risk to this program, if any. It's a voluntary program. Community owners can choose to participate. Regarding the manufactured housing segment and where it's at nationally, Moody's Investors Services stated in a public statement on February 12th of this year that they see a continuing deterioration in 2003 in the manufactured housing business. Access to affordable financing is a critical component in helping stabilize this housing sector. Consumers, manufactured home retailers, lenders, manufacturers, community owners are in favor of this bill. The bill is good for everyone. It has virtually no downside. That concludes my testimony. Thank you for allowing me to testify in favor of Senate Bill 328. I welcome your questions if you have any.
Thank you. Any questions? We'll come back to the panel. Okay.
Good afternoon, committee members, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Diane Belt. I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. You probably wonder what tax collectors, why they'd be interested in a bill like Senate Bill 328, but we're very interested. We are supportive of this bill along with the amendments that Don has recommended. We would like to see that leasehold is a recorded document. It's important to counties in that our job is to collect taxes. By taking it out of the personal property realm, it puts it into real property, which typically will, in this type of lending environment, there will be an escrow account in which the folks will make their tax payment monthly to the lender, and then they'll return that payment to us every November. So that makes it a lot nicer for us, takes it out of the warrant process and puts it into a six-year foreclosure cycle. So I think for the consumer, it all the way will be a much better process for them. It will work for the county as well, as long as we see that amendment where the lease is recorded. And thank you for letting me speak today, and I'd answer any questions.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the county see any difference in tax collections going from personal to real property?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes. Personal property taxes, which would be manufactured homes that sit on land that are not owned by the same party, and business personal property taxes. When those aren't paid, we record a judgment against those, and that leads to garnishment or seizure of the home. Typically, we're not in the real estate business, so we don't go out every year and seize people's homes right away. Real property is a very strict process. You have typically 6 years to pay your taxes before the county would actually take it and then auction it off. In a situation like this, where you have a much more secured financing, the chances of that happening are pretty slim.
Well, I think that's a good answer, but I also wanted to know, if we're switching it from personal property to real property, it seems like, not that I care, but you'll get less tax collections, because currently at personal property rates, they can't get a mortgage at a lower rate.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, it has nothing to do with that. It's the assessed value times the rate equals the tax.
It doesn't matter whether it's personal or real?
No. No.
Oh, that's good.
No.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Chair. Anybody wants to answer this is fine. I just clarify for this. It says this would be eligible for a holder of a leasehold estate of 30 years or more. Does that mean they have to have a lease? Yes, I read that as 30 years or more. Is that common? I mean, I've got a lot of people who don't have leases at all. Someone could just explain that a little bit more.
Yeah.
Is that more common than I think? I mean, I've got a lot of people who are, you know, month-to-month leases or no leases at all.
Right. That's one of the Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, that's one of the benefits of this program, is I think we will see an increase in long-term leases in manufactured home communities, which by and large are not common in the state of Oregon. They're more common in the state of Washington. We do have some communities with up to 25-year leases, but the majority of them are, as you said, they're either annual one-year leases or month-to-month, and we see that as a benefit for the next 30 years. If people enter into this program, it's outlined in writing what their lease payment's going to be, what the escalators are, if any, if they're tied to a cost of living index or pass-throughs of additional maintenance costs within the community or utilities or whatever. So there's a sure stability factor there that doesn't exist today. But it is a lease. It is a lease, and it is a lease granted by the owner of the community.
Can I follow up there?
Sure.
Since actually you have a number of parks in my district, and speaking just on behalf of your own corporation, is this if this bill were to be enacted, it does require your agreement on this to, in order to make this actually have an effect for homeowners.
Mm-hmm.
Are you, because of your support of the bill, indicating that your corporation would be offering these longer leases in order that people in those communities can take advantage of this?
Our corporation is definitely, excuse me, protocol, Mr. Chairman, Senator. Our corporation is for this bill, and we see it being enacted in some of our communities. However, we are, by and large, a fee management company. And so for those communities that we manage for individual investors or owners, some are going to participate in it. Others are definitely not going to participate in it. And some of those communities that are full now and don't have any kind of a problem are, frankly, not likely to participate in it. We also own a few communities, and our communities that are company-owned are going to participate in it, in both Oregon and Washington. But clearly, I don't want to misread you. There will be a number of communities that undoubtedly will not enter into it, largely because of the fact that a particular owner may just be either objectionable to long-term leases or not really have the see the need. Kind of a personal choice.
Do you see any problem with successors and interest? I mean, you say you go 10 years and somebody either sells, dies. Then how do you handle that situation?
Mr. Chairman, the lease is discontinued at that point, is my understanding of the program, and so a new lease would be negotiated with a new homeowner if the home changes hands.
So, is that going to cause the bankers any problem? Or?
Cause the bankers any?
I mean, for Freddie Mac or for these leasing?
No, not that I can see, no more than in any other real property transaction. I think that if there's a new homeowner that comes in and they don't require financing, they pay cash for the home, they may very well end up entering into a month-to-month or annual lease versus a long-term lease. Long-term lease is primarily designed to help adhere to and give access to the Freddie Mac conforming loan program and those interest rates.
So you're saying basically on death, then the lease would be gone, the leases. That's written into the lease, or how's that? How does that?
I'm going to refer to Don on that one. Details.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure I know that detail. Now, the bill doesn't speak to those subjects as to the content of the lease, only that it be a leasehold interest of 30 or more interest or 30 or more years. I thought Freddie Mac had some dealt with the issue of death. I know they deal with the issue of evictions. They deal with the issues related to non-payment of property taxes, for example. I can't imagine that they haven't dealt with the issue of death of the borrower. But I don't know that answer, how that works out.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I believe that I had two different thoughts, though, as far specifically as death. If the home goes to heirs, the lease continues. That I do remember. I believe I'm very correct on that. If the home is sold, if an estate should take possession of the home goes through probate, home is sold, I think it's up to the new home buyer to determine to negotiate a new lease or not. Once the mortgage is satisfied, in other words...
Any further questions? We still have Mr. Brenneman to discuss. Okay, thank you very much.
Oh,
okay.
Actually, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. One quick question.
Yes.
Mr. Miner, Senate Bill 468, does that bill need to pass in order to facilitate this bill if it was to pass?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, no. This bill stands by itself. But that if both pass, I believe there need to be conforming amendments to make sure that this bill doesn't wash out.
Can I ask one more question? Yes.
Just another thing in front of my mind. You mentioned that that upon sale of the home, that the lease would then be invalid. Is that what you're saying? You'd have to negotiate a new lease with a new owner? Is that what
yes.
you're saying? Okay. Would that, and I don't know what Freddie Mac's position is on that, but doesn't that in itself make a quality of sale issue involved in terms of being able to sell that property? Because it would be contingent upon, if the lease, which is gives the value to, obviously, a lot of cases, the home itself, mm-hmm. is subject to renegotiation, doesn't that also might impede, I would think, the sale of a home? It makes it more difficult, especially if you had an unwilling leasehold. Am I thinking this through differently than... I'm looking at a worst-case scenario. I want to, you got a home and you want to sell it, and all of a sudden the owner says, well, I don't want to do any more of these, and wouldn't that make it more difficult to sell that home for someone else? You know, they've got a piece of now real property, but they can't get a lender who's going to lend them money if, in fact, they don't have access to that same lease that the original owner had.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, I don't really foresee that being a serious problem, and the reason that I don't is because it's not likely that all of the homes in any given community are going to be under this lease program, just those that required the financing. So it would, at very worst, put that home on par with every other home that's reselling in the community that may not have that underlying lease. We haven't. There's not a lot of history behind this program, so there's a certain amount of assumption that goes on when you think about the long-term aspects of it. But one of those that I see is that, and this is certainly the attitude of the community owners that are entertaining this program, is once they're in this program and in the business of long-term leases, they see themselves in the business as long as a community exists as a manufactured home community, which with 30-year leases in effect, it's going to exist for a long time. Which, by the way, I might add, certainly takes away the problem that could exist if a manufactured home community owner today decides to close the community and evict the homes and build a Walmart there. That's not likely to happen with all these long-term leases in effect, which gives the homeowners an extra sense of stability that they don't have today. I hope I answered your question.
Were you reading my mind on that last
No.
I have that happening in my district.
Mr. Chair, the terms and conditions that are required, the mandatory terms required by Freddie Mac can be found on the internet. I'll copy off a copy of the lease and see if I can't discover that answer in there.
Okay. That'd be interesting. Mm-hmm. Further questions? This group, we have Mr. Brennan.
No, I'd like to hear Mr. Brennan.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you coming down. John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Brenneman. I represent Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. It's a trade association of about 450 parks around the state that rent spaces to people who own their own manufactured home. About, I think it was nearly 2 years ago when Don Miner and I first discussed this issue, and my own personal opinion at the time, it sounded very favorable as a good marketing tool for some park owners who might like to use it to fill spaces or keep them filled. And the majority opinion in our group is still that they want to move ahead and support it. It was a split decision in our last board meeting. Nothing's easy, it seems, when it comes to manufactured park issues. There are some questions, similar to questions raised here in the community or in the committee. Just briefly, we did ask our attorney for the association to review the bill, told him the meeting was today, and asked him to expedite that, but he hasn't finished his evaluation. And I'd like a little more time to work with Don. Some of our members had a question about whether or not the bill had to state 30 years in exact terms or whether it could be in the bill 5 years more than the term of the loan. And as we still have that and a few other questions to ask, but landlords or park owners for a long time have had that ability to, when a home changes hands, they have that ability to approve that new person coming in the park, and we still want to maintain that ability to do that. That's not just for the interest of the park owner, but also for the other residents that live in the park, because criminal background checks go on, and it is in the interest in the full community that new person coming in is going to be able to fit well into that park. So at this point in time, we are in favor, but we're moving slowly, and we hope the committee will allow my group to work a little bit more with Don and the other proponents to make sure everyone feels comfortable with the bill. Any questions?
Yes.
Senator Buck Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brenneman, there's been a lot of parks that have lost rent and homeowners in there. There's a lot of repossessions and vacant homes. So this, to me, sounds like it would be a way to have greater sales and more opportunity to fill those parks back up. Is that sort of what you're thinking as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, for some of our park owners, I think it's going to be a great marketing tool. And for an earlier question to the other panel that was up here for Senator Metzger, he questioned whether there were long leases out there. The most I am personally aware of, one of our members who has since sold the park and has since died, but he was a member of the legislative body, built park in Newport, and he used 99 years leases as his marketing tool. He tied them in with the Portland CPI and then the pass-throughs of taxes and other costs outside of his control. And it has worked very well. So we do have as high as 99 years, and I know a lot of the newer parks are offering longer-term leases for stability, to have a formula written in the lease so that people have a little more certainty as to what they're paying in rent. But I represent parks of all sizes, up to 450, I think, is the largest park in spaces, and I have a park that has as few as four. So I have all kinds of different park owners that have their opinion as to whether this is good or bad. Majority opinion is that it's a good tool.
Thank you. Thanks. You want to come testify? Sure. Please come up. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Schwach, and I represent Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. I appreciate this opportunity. We feel that this bill has a lot going for it. One of the big problems with manufactured housing now, among several, is that financing is terribly expensive. And I think that's why we've seen an awful lot of the repossessions that we've seen. The other thing, my personal feeling about these long-term leases is that it certainly would give the resident who was buying this house a more secure feeling that they were going to be there for a while, rather than, you know, at the end of 2 years, if I decide I don't want to renew your lease because I want to do something different, we could, you know, begins to get some problems. So I really feel that this bill certainly deserves to be looked at very carefully, examine the ins and outs of it, and hopefully move forward with it.
Just one. Thank you. That's what I was thinking about. I saw you in the back of the room, and I was hoping you'd come forward, Pat, and chat, because when Mr. Miner was talking about financing, the rates are currently 13%, I think.
At least, if you can find them. If you can find that kind of financing now.
That's exactly right, because I think I've had discussion that the financing is not really available.
No.
And so this really gives you an opportunity to get not only the same rates that stick-built homes are getting, but also to get financing in
that's
the first
correct.
Instance.
Yeah. The financing, as far as conventional financing that's been out there for manufactured housing, is just almost non-existent now.
Is there, I think, from what you and I had a conversation, there's only one lender doing
it? And then I understand that gets a little shaky on occasion, so it's not real promising at this point, but this certainly would has the possibility of creating some good financing. Other questions? If
questions? Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Appreciate it. Anybody else testifying on this? We'll have some amendments, and Mr. Brennerman has some issues that he wants to continue work on, so we'll close the public hearing, not go into a work session. Open up a public hearing on 343, Senate Bill 343. So, you want to make a quick discussion on this? I'm going to get you involved in this today. What's wrong with
that? Okay, sir. Senate Bill 343.
Go ahead.
Merges certification authority with enforcement authority for persons who install and inspect water system cross connections and test backflow prevention device assemblies. Transfers certifying authority from Department of Human Services, Building Codes Division of Department of Consumer and Business Services. No revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact, no statement issued.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you. Ron, you're here all the time. Please proceed. Introduce yourself.
Thank you, Senator Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Ron Murray. I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters Local 290. And what I'm going to ask for today is your indulgence that the committee kind of listen to my little story and then let us move along and perhaps finalize some of the rules that we're going to propose. So, in the 2001 legislative session, there was a work group that was put together to address some of the issues that were happening in the backflow industry. And the backflow industry is comprised of plumbers, backflow testers, water purveyors, a very, very broad assortment of stakeholders whose job we all see, I think, to protect the potable water supply. And through that, there was regulation through the Oregon State Health Division and the Building Codes Division, and many of these lines of jurisdiction were blurred and were somewhat gray areas. Through the task force, we identified 22 primary stakeholder groups, and all of these folks are represented upon the committee. And through the past 2 years, it's been almost 2 years, we've put together a very, very lengthy, comprehensive list of rules to address some of the problems that all of the stakeholders, I think, feel were present in the industry. Moving toward the end of this process, it became apparent that perhaps the Health Division actually did not have the statutory authority to move forward with the program, and with some of the, I think, revenue and fiscal impact and so forth and so on that we're all undergoing, there was discussion of actually taking the program and shifting some of the responsibilities from the Health Division to the Building Code Division. But keeping in mind that one of the criteria, one of the main purposes of this group was to delineate this fine line of demarcation between what a plumber does and what the water purveyor and the public entities are responsible for. And so that's the bill that actually you see before you, Senate Bill 343. And the work group, I do want to say, has worked very hard and cooperatively and so forth and so on. Since the bill has been introduced, one of the things that we feel like we can accomplish is to try to take the rules that we have been able to written, and as I say, they're very, very lengthy and comprehensive, and go back and using these rules and this bill, basically take this piece of legislation and allow the Health Division to reorganize and to go forth with the program as these rules were written. And so that's actually what I'm here to ask you for, is just the opportunity for all the groups once again to kind of finalize the rules, bring them forth to you, and take this bill and implement that process.
So you're looking for some amendments?
Yes, sir. There would be a significant amendment package. And if I can answer any questions, so I guess I'm not offering you too much now other than asking your indulgence and allowing this bill to be a placeholder until we come back with a finalized form. But if I can answer any questions regarding backflow devices, indoor plumbing, or anything, it's you've got me here, and it's for...
Any questions at all?
Yeah. Well, he opened it up for plumbing questions. How come when you take a shower and you flush the toilet or run the water somewhere else in the house, your shower goes bananas?
through the chair, Senator Walker.
Anna's out of her shower.
I can answer that question, and it's almost done overtime, so it only cost you about $800. But actually, it's because you just either have inadequate water pressure or an inadequate water supply.
Really?
But while I have you here, I would like to offer you one little plumbing tip, and that is on your kitchen sink, you have a little diffuser there where you can spray water. If you take a rubber band and tie it around that little handle and tie it down, the first person that comes and lifts that handle up, they get sprayed. It's a great trick. You'll have to try that sometime.
Well, Mr. Murray, that's not actually very funny, because in my apartment in Salem one day, the sprayer got stuck on and I didn't know it, and next morning I lifted up the faucet and sprayed the front of me, and I was late for committee. So That's not a fire hydrant.
That was an excuse, I think.
Through the chair to Senator Walker. My wife actually takes that sprayer and she sticks it in the thing because the plumber in the house hasn't gotten around to fixing it yet.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha.
Thank you very much for your indulgence.
Thank you, Ron. I appreciate it. We'll work on these amendments. Grant, go ahead.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the state public health officer with the Department of Human Services, and I'm just here to say we're supportive of Mr. Murray's testimony. As he mentioned, we've been working with a large group of stakeholders over the last couple of years to develop these new rules, which we think when we come back with amendments will satisfy the committee and satisfy all the stakeholders.
Yeah, some city folks back. Are you guys worried about this bill? Someone hasn't talked to us.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Willie Tiffany with the League of Cities. We're in full agreement with Mr. Murray's testimony. We did have representatives of water purveyors on the committee, and we did have some concern about moving forward with the specific language in this bill before that committee had an opportunity to kind of come together with a comprehensive package. And I believe they are close to consensus. So with the chair's indulgence, we'd ask to allow some time for that to happen.
Yes, we're out and do some good work. Agree. Senator Betts.
Well, since Senator Walker has asked other funny questions, I would like to ask Mr. Murray. I enjoyed seeing getting the whole scoop on the backflow with Mr. Murray here a few months ago. And I was just curious. I see the city of Portland is thinking about spending tens and tens of millions of dollars to cover the reservoir so that they can't be contaminated. And I would be curious as to your thought as to whether that would, in fact, solve that problem based on what you demonstrated to me with the backflow devices and the plumbing systems.
Senator Nelson, Senator Metzger, it's really difficult for me to comment on, for example, covering the reservoirs, I think, in the city of Portland. What we are really trying to address here is contamination of the water supply system through another source. And to kind of give you an idea how it works, it can be so simple as if somebody were to, let's say, take a pump, and if they wanted to contaminate the water system, you could actually pump it in through, like, your kitchen faucet. That's oversimplistic, but it's devices such as that. Or, for example, a boiler that creates pressure, and the pressure can overwhelm the city water pressure or well pressure. It can actually force contaminants back in the system. And backflow devices work on kind of that principle. So totally different idea. What we're really doing here is working with plumbing systems and not, I guess, the central water system as a whole. So that's kind of an evasive answer. I apologize.
Well, and Mr. Chair, if I could respond, Senator Metzger, you know, what covering the reservoirs would do, or whatever they decide to do with treating water from those reservoirs, is making sure that there is good, uncontaminated water getting to the end source. What backflow is doing is once it gets to the end source or close to the end source, if it were to get contaminated, that it doesn't go back into the system. So they really are two different issues.
Right. But I think the point is, though, Ron, am I not mistaken, that you can contaminate a water supply elsewhere than going at the reservoir source in order to contaminate?
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Okay. Any other further questions?
Well, that's a good advice today.
Anything else want to
say? I wrote the bad thing, Senator Walker.
Well, will you guys work on the amendments and get your work group going and come back to us.
Thank you.
So we'll close the public hearing, and we will vote all of the
committee hearing. Balancing valve. Okay.